Thank you, Dick. I appreciate it very much. My name's Sandy. I'm an alcoholic. And I really enjoyed Bob's presentation. I love the way his mind works. It's fascinating to me. I just could listen to it. And I suppose the in thinking about the difference in our two books, I personally love both of them equally and think they complement each other in many wonderful ways. And as I go through things, I go, oh, this is much better in the big book. Or then I'll go, no, it's much better in the 12 and 12. As far as understanding a spiritual point that Bill's trying to make, sometimes you just have a better analogy or a story or something like that. But clearly, if you want to be a new alcoholic and find something that has to be the greatest line in the big book, it's the one that says, we've now completed step 7. That has to be the greatest line in the big book. There's no other step that you've completed, you know, so it's just, whoa. I read the prayer, I'm out of here. Now, that's a misunderstanding of what's there, but I could see where it, I could see, that's what I remember. Hey, next. And anyway, when I looked into some of the history, as I mentioned yesterday, clearly, the second book could have just been the 12 traditions, because that was what was going on, the troubles in the groups and the grapevine articles. So this was known quantity. We'd already seen these. And so that book could have just been, here's our 12 traditions. But instead, it's called the 12 and 12, and there's another presentation of the steps. And the research that I did indicated, this is one historian, said that Bill was concerned with the slips and the fact that many AAs were settling for just mere sobriety, if you know what I'm talking about. I'm sober. I just go to meetings, put the plug in the jug. I'm sober. I've got 8 years. And there it is. If I was doing that, you can't walk up and criticize me and say, hey, you're doing it wrong. So the only, Bill's always been a program of attraction rather than promotion. So maybe he could put something out there that when these people read it, they would be inspired, attracted into trying something that took them a little further than just not drinking. Another quote was, it was Bill's deepest understanding of the AA way of life. And Bill said, serenity comes only when one embraces a new way of life by utilizing AA spiritual principles in all aspects of daily life. And then finally, it was going beyond living sober to living spiritually. Now, oddly enough, there were plenty of people who didn't see the need for the 12 and 12. We have pockets around the country where you go into some club or something and you go, you know, the 12, we don't talk about the 12 and 12 in here, really. And they make it very clear, this is not a joke. We don't talk about the 12 and 12 in here. And I respect that, but I never stop and ask how that happened, that you got this policy. But I would guess that it happened something like this. It's 1953, and the book comes out. And people with 10 years of sobriety are going, who the hell needs this? I got 10 years sobriety on the big book. What is he trying to do? Screw our minds up? Confuse us? You don't need that. You just don't need it. So guess what they tell their pigeons, the people they're sponsoring? Don't read the 12 and 12. You don't need to read it. You can do fine. I've done fine on the big book. Look at me. You got to go along. It's your sponsor. So now that person gets someone they're sponsoring. Guess what they tell that person? Stay away from the 12 and 12. So this person who passed the word in 1953 is still being quoted, even though he's been dead for 40 years. And so I've rarely heard someone who said, I read closely the 12 and 12, and I can see why you wouldn't want to read it. It's generally a classic case of contempt prior to investigation. No, I haven't read it, and I'm not going to. But anyway, it's there. Whether it's being praised or ignored, it arrived on the scene in 1953. I would say the biggest two things that Bill wanted to emphasize in the 12 and 12 was that AA was a way of life. It was an entire way of life. You could consider that you were living it as a way of life if you were sponsoring people and you kept passing on the message of the 12 steps. It feels like as you are passing on the message to the person you're sponsoring that you're doing more step work. You could give yourself credit for doing more step work, right? Here I am, I'm talking deeply about step four. But you're helping someone do the steps. You're not doing it yourself, but it feels like you're constantly involved in personal step work. And if we took a closer look, we might find, actually, I'm really not that involved. I'm involved in teaching about step work. So the way of life, and then the second thing is humility. Those are the two main points that are made in the 12 and 12. Humility, I think, appears twice in the big book, and it's on a tangential basis that somebody had humility or something. There's no real discussion of it. And we find that the quote, it's in step five, that the underlying principle of all our steps is humility. That's it. The attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of all our steps. So it went from a rather undiscussed thing to the number one, humility. So there was a great deal more discussion. And we have meetings on humility, and we find how difficult it is to talk about. You get there, and it's, what do you think humility means for you? And you find an awkwardness in presenting, your case. And as time goes on, in other words, I remember when I started reading that humility was one of my great friends, that if I could practice this, it would make life so much easier. And so for me, what it has come to mean is a constant distancing myself from self-sufficiency, moving further and further away from self-sufficiency, letting God do all the work. You know, somebody said, God will help you with the things that you can't do yourself. He'll also help you with the things you can do yourself. He's glad to help with everything. But our ego likes to find excuses for leaving them out. Like, see, I can do this myself, so shove off, God. I like the feeling of doing it myself. I once gave up, I only gave up smoking once. And actually I tried in early sobriety, but then later on I had 8 years. And people had told me that they stopped smoking by praying, by allowing God to help them, and made it a spiritual challenge in the program. I decided that I would take the drill sergeant approach and I would just not smoke. You know, like, don't drink even if your butt's gonna fall off. So I was gonna not smoke even if my butt was gonna fall off. So no matter how bad I felt, when I complained to myself, I said, shut up, you're not getting a cigarette. And that's that. And I go, shut up. And I have not had a cigarette in 40 years or whatever it is. Now, so I thought stopping smoking was clearly a sign of spiritual progress, that you're getting rid of something. You're getting rid of something that's killing you. Not smoking is a very good thing. So, but looking at it on a spiritual scale, what do you think that did to my pride? Did I move closer to God or further away from God when I stopped smoking on my own? It made me look for other things I could do on my own. Maybe I could forgive on my own. Maybe I could get over resentment on my own. Maybe I could do all kinds of things on my own. And when we do it, the ego loves it. And you just sit there with that self-satisfied feeling, I just made some more progress in the program on my own. And it feels good. Yeah, I don't gossip anymore. I just gave it up. And it feels great. And so it is so simple, and that's why humility is telling us that we're not going to make any spiritual progress on our own. Don't even think about it. The definition of it is that God helped you do it. That's what it was. It involves our Creator intimately in our lives. Let's see. I had to read quite a few history books before I found one that criticized the 12 and 12. And it was Francis Hartigan's book. And what it said was that the big book was the real program. And that the 12 and 12 is a watered-down version of it, and that it's less spiritual. It's just this. And that it left out the miracles. It left out a lot of the lines where we're catapulted into the fourth dimension, and a lot of the lines that Bill likes to use, we suddenly realize that God is doing for us, and the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way that's indeed miraculous, that kind of language, which is exciting. And I love it. I mean, whenever I read it, it makes me feel good. But it also makes me feel like there isn't a lot more work to do. That, boy, when you have that certainty that your Creator is in your heart and lives in the room, just live with it. Just enjoy it. Just be with it. And you don't get that much in the 12 and 12. The 12 and 12 is just constantly going, there's a long way to go. Don't rest on your laurels. It's a long way to go. I like the big book where it's, we're there, and I see the white light, and it's wonderful. So both of them have to coexist. If you just had, there's a long way to go. You might get tired, you know what I'm saying? So I'd hate to just get sober on the 12 and 12. Although there's a group in New York, I ran into a guy from New York where they don't read the big book, they just use the 12 and 12, which of course everyone in the room goes, well, that's wrong. Yeah. So, see how fast we got rid of judging. So he started telling me how hard it is to do the fourth step. You know how many questions are in the fourth step in the 12 and 12? And they write out the question, and then you got to write a longhand answer to the question. And what about the 12th step in the 12? There must be 30 questions in there. Are you doing this? Are you doing that? What about this? What about that? And you got to put them all down and write them out. So I don't think it's a piece of cake to do that. But here's some of the observations that I made. The preamble, or the foreword, a lot of people have taken, there's probably plenty of people in this room that can quote that definition of our steps. I know there's plenty. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, here we are again with that theme, a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and make the sufferer happily and usefully whole. So it's not as glowing a promise as some of the ones in the big book, that you will see a burst of white light and float on a raft on the river. It's that you will become happily and usefully whole, which is sort of a more realistic. You will be complete. There's something about we all sensed that there was something missing all our lives. And then we get the paradox, if there's something missing, then we have to get rid of things in order to find it. Isn't that funny? We don't get it, we get rid of things in order to find it. And if there's one other thing that is predominant in the 12 and 12, it's a constant reminder. Bob was hammering at home that you're still powerless. Those first steps, don't forget them. You are still powerless. You got 20 years sobriety, and you are no less powerless than you were on your first day. That sounds, I don't like that. My ego can't stand it. I'm just as bad off as I was the first day. You are just as powerless. The only thing standing between you and the first drink is your higher power. And you quoted that in the 10th step. What we have is a daily reprieve, contingent on our spiritual condition. This is really hammered home in the 12 and 12, over and over again. And Ernie Kurtz, in his history books, if he hammers anything home, it's the limitations that alcoholics have. You are limited. You are powerless. And you need help to get through the rest of your life. You are never going to get to a place where you don't need help. Now, if you phrase it that way, it sounds, oh, man, I got a bad deal. And yet, as you move along and you start experiencing the rewards of spiritual way of life, you hear such outlandish statements as, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. When you're new, you go, why? Why would you be glad? Because it drove me into a relationship with a higher power I never would have had. If I hadn't been an alcoholic, I would not understand spiritual awakening. I wouldn't understand the fellowship of the Spirit. I wouldn't understand any of these things. I mean, I could still be having a reasonable life and all this, but I would have missed out on the highest level life experience that people can have, which is to become aware of their own spirituality, to become aware that they are connected to their own creator in a way that they never dreamed of, and that when we make this connection and have this awakening, as we look around at the world, it looks fair, it makes sense, and it just transforms everything. So that, in other words, where we saw mean people and we saw unfairness and we saw all these things, now we have the power to understand that this person's doing the best they can. They were brought up, somebody beat them up and they're struggling. What they need is love and for me to go over and talk to them. That's what they need. Instead of criticizing and seeing, look at all these bad people. And then you don't see that anymore. You see people who are disconnected from their higher power and they're lost and they're trying to figure out life on their own. They don't have a program. They have a gang or whatever it is, or some sort of a debate club where you can be superior to everyone in the universe and be able to successfully debate that there is no such thing as God and win every time. But nobody's happy. Here are some of the other observations that I made. There's no discussion in the Big Book of instinctual drives. I found that discussion in the 12 and 12 fabulous, because it explained where the character defects came from that I had. Everyone is born with these instinctual drives. Nobody doesn't get them. And the character defects come from these instinctual drives that are out of control. The average person in growing up, on their own observation, they see that they are experiencing discomfort. I don't have enough money. I don't have a relationship. Nobody likes me. You know what I mean? They have no standing in school. I told my sponsor after I had 6 months, I said, I've been looking around. Nobody likes me. And he said, don't worry, you haven't met everyone yet. That's not a comforting answer. You haven't met everyone yet. What I was doing, I was seeing everything wrong. There were plenty of people that did like me, but it didn't look like they did, because maybe they were telling me the truth. Why would they do that? It's a very painful thing to be told the truth. So these instinctual drives in step four, I suddenly understood where all this came from. And that since I didn't have anybody helping me to figure this out, the only possible conclusion I could reach is, in order to be happy in life, you had to satisfy these demands. And if you have a sense that you don't have enough money, the only thing that will fix it is money. And so you go out and you get it. Maybe you earn it, maybe you rob it, or whatever it is. But when you get it, it's not enough. You would have said, geez, if I had $10,000 in the bank, I would go to sleep at night, and that would be the end of the money problem. And then you get $10,000 in there. It didn't help at all. Somebody could take it. How long is it going to last? You got to get more. You got to get more. And so each demand, whether it was sex, more partners, whether it was working your way up the ladder at work so you get more respect, and finally I'm the boss, and that didn't fix it. I'm still not important enough. Maybe I better run for Congress. I better do this. So we're constantly chasing the demands from the instinctual drives, and we never get there. And Bill says, no one ever told us about spiritually reducing the demands so that they aren't bothering us. Spiritually reducing the demands down to where they're supposed to be to have us function as human beings so that we will reproduce and will form societies and things like that. But they're not the purpose of living. They felt like it was the purpose of living. So what a wonderful understanding to add to the big book. And we were doing a four-step inventory to understand where this stuff that we're inventorying came from. That we didn't create it. We're not this bad person who created the sex drive. I'm not the bad person who created the desire for attention. I'm just a normal human being with the same instinctual drives that everybody else has. And they're driving me crazy because I don't know how to be a grown-up. I don't know how to not have these things dominate me. Well, good. We're going to inventory them. We're going to see how they're dominating you. And then we're going to have them reduced. We're entirely ready to have God reduce these demands. And even making amends has a tremendous effect on reducing those demands. So I think that that's a marvelous addition to combine with the big book. It's emphasized in the big book. Powerlessness is emphasized. We get our strength out of our weakness. This is, I tease around and I criticize our preamble just so that we have an understanding of what's going on here. Share our experience, strength, and hope. What strength? What strength have you got? Oh, I have the strength of weakness. That's what I have. What do you share when you're talking to telling your story? Do you get up there and go, I was very strong always. Nothing bothered me. I got through life. Everything overpowered me. I was getting crushed. I was getting killed out there. I was just in. So you're up there sharing your failure. If you shared your strength, the new person wouldn't identify. They go, oh, I don't know anything about that. But when you share your powerlessness, then we identify. Because, you know, you don't talk about that in normal conversation with the guys. Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm not afraid of anything. And finally, we're being honest. Yeah, I was afraid all the time. I was afraid in second grade. So we're talking about this weakness, and that leads to the power. By the admission of the weakness is the crack in the ego that allows this spiritual power to come in. It's the only doorway that spiritual power can come in is through where we are surrendering. So we're really sharing our experience, powerlessness, and hope. And by admitting our powerlessness, we have access to strength that's not our own. It comes through us from another source. And so that goes on and on a constant reminder of that. In other words, Bill is looking at things that as the years go by, we need to constantly remind ourselves of. And there's a lot of that in the 12 and 12. We got to don't forget this, don't forget that. It is based on, you know, having had, in 53, he had almost 20 years. And so he's looking at, where am I failing? Where are the weaknesses here? And it's, a lot of it is lack of humility and not seeing that AA is more than sobriety. In other words, we hand out the medallions for sobriety. But what we really are, the target is peace of mind and serenity. That's what a way of life will do. And of course, the paradox, it's probably in the big book, but I find it in the 12 and 12 a little bit more. I'm trying to combine this with two stories. There's a sense that we were a slave to alcohol. Everybody can relate to that analogy. I mean, alcohol was my master. It said, you don't have any money? Well, you better steal some, because if you don't get a drink soon, you're going to have a seizure or something. You know what I mean? Okay, well, geez, I don't want to. Give me your money. I'm not a crook. I'm just sick. I need money, you know. Yeah, you look like a crook to me. So then we come in and we get sober and we get a sense that we're free. We use that word a lot. Free. I'm free from being a slave to alcohol. So are you free? Are you free now, or are you now a slave to your character defects? Couldn't I have lived with the illusion for a week? I mean, why do you have to ruin it right away and just start right in? You're not free at all. Well, let's look and see. And then we start down our inventory of what we did that day. And there were a lot of things that we did that we wish we hadn't chosen to do. And we find out the only freedom we can get is by depending on God. So, free will, the most precious gift that we're given, we give back. That's a pretty good thing. God gave me free will. It's the most precious thing I have. I'm going to give it back to God. And that's how we get free. Made a decision to turn our freedom over to God. And now we're in a position to be able to live by spiritual principles that we wanted to do but didn't have the power to live up to. How many times did we let ourselves down? I'm going to be nicer. I'm going to not lie. I'm not going to do that. And here we are. Well, where were you? It's amazing to me. Somewhere in my teens, I determined that the truth was dangerous. So that if I went to the drugstore, my mother said, where were you? I said, the grocery store. I didn't have to lie. I didn't have to say I was at the grocery store. Something told me, don't say the drugstore, which is the truth. Just tell something else. And it's around there today, you know. I go out for a walk. Where were you? I was shopping. And then I go, no, I wasn't shopping. I was out for a walk. Well, why didn't you say so? I don't know. My first instinct is make up something. and then decide if the truth is all right. There's such a... I heard Tom I talk a little bit about this, that the first thing that pops in your head is a lie. So we can see this emphasis on getting away from self-sufficiency. It is one of the great gifts of the 12 and 12. It takes away the great joy of we've arrived, the big book, you know, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. I've got his hand. It's going to stay like this forever. You know, and the book closes with that, you know. That you'll surely meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny and blah, blah, blah. We need that. That's absolutely necessary. Those wonderful analogies give us this great spirit of what's really happening. But then we got to come back to how dangerous a sense of well-being can be. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, we want you to stop feeling bad about yourself, so we're going to give you a tremendous sense of well-being. But we know that you can't handle that. It's going to ruin you. Oh, you mean I got to be depressed? No. You can't take credit for it. You can have it, but you can't take credit for it. So, well, how do I do that? You have to get self-sufficiency out of your mind and replace it with humility. You have to thank God for everything, everything, everything. Never take credit for anything. And when we do that, it's really comfortable. It's wonderful. Unfortunately, we're going to have our ego for the rest of our lives. And it doesn't like this deal at all. It would, if it had its way, this tape would be a blank when it came out. So that none of these words got said. And just it would be substituted, just do your best. You can beat them. You can conquer them. Get out there. Come on. Where's your pride? Pride? It's a defect. I was so shocked. I was in the Marine Corps. And the sponsor was in the Marine Corps. And he said, you know, pride's a defect. And I said, hey, Bill, we're both in the Marine Corps, the few, the proud. We're going to shorten it to the few? Whoa. So I went in the dictionary. I'm looking it up, and it's a character defect. It is the top sin out of the seven deadly sins. Pride causes 90% of the problems, and the other six deadly sins have 10%. That's how powerful pride is. Because pride is delighted that we exist as a separate person from God. Separate. And, of course, that causes our problems. And Bob was starting to refer to that circle that Chuck Chamberlain draws in his book. He draws a circle and says, this is the universe. This is everything there is. This is God. This is everything there is. And then he makes a little dot outside the circle. And this is the alcoholic. And I said, how do you get outside the circle? How could you exist in addition to everything that exists? You just make up a story that you exist in addition to everything that exists and believe it. And so we have that as a foundation. I'm not even connected to the universe. I'm in addition to the universe. I have my own world. And I'm the only guy in it. But at least I'm in charge. Nobody's screwing around in there. That's the perfect picture, that circle and the little dot over here. How did I get outside the circle? Well, if you want to be inside the circle, you can't be in charge. I'll put one foot in the circle and one foot. You want to be in charge of something, right? So our tendency as we get time in the program is to feel incorrectly that we're more capable as a human being to live on our own. It just feels that way. So I think Bill in the 12 and 12 was just trying to go after us and keep reminding us this is a way of life. Humility has to be second nature to you. And otherwise, you can have very unserene sobriety. But you'll go, but at least I'm sober. I'm sober. That's all that matters. Yes and no. We know what we mean by that. We don't mean 10 years of resentment. And I'm so proud that I could stand the pain of all that resentment to get more time than you have. Right? So what do they say? Whoever got up first in the morning has the most sobriety, and then half the room goes, that's wrong. Okay, let's see. Let's go to page 2. Okay, we have very little discussion in the big book about how you harm people. We have a few examples of the man took money and he made amends in front of the church. You remember the thing? So there's one or two. But when we get to the eighth step in the 12 and 12, Bill really goes out of his way to give us a much bigger selection of harms, which after you finish reading it, you go, I don't need that help. I was in much better shape before we came up with a joke. If we really wanted to do this step as well as possible, we would put our picture when we're getting ready to take the eighth step, put it in post offices, churches, put it all around town. This man is Bill B., and he felt that he harmed people, and he wants to make amends to them. If you've been harmed by this man, please drop a line to post office box so-and-so and outline the harm. I think that list would be longer than the one we could think up on our own, where we would definitely minimize harm. I didn't know gossip was harming till I read it in the 12 and 12. I thought you're just passing on some information. I just didn't see it that way. I didn't realize that if you withheld more affection from one child than the other, that was harm. I didn't realize that if you stayed grumpy the whole time, it was just to punish the office because they had a good weekend and I didn't. So I would just be the whole day. Didn't see that. And then the crowning blow came when I was up in Washington, D.C., and due to certain circumstances, all my friends said I had to start going to Al-Anon. I'm not going into the circumstances. Relationship, okay, you got it. And I stayed there 10 years. And I would be sitting there, and some young woman would come in and relay. And she was terrible. She was just wiped out. She was so hurt, just crushed. And she'd relay what her husband did that caused her to be in this horrible shape. And I'd go, what the hell's wrong with that? Do you follow what I'm saying? We have a long way to go in understanding how much harm, in the spiritual sense, we do during the course of a day. And of course, Bill goes and points out that alcoholics specialize in bringing out the worst in people. Now, if you bring out the worst in people everywhere you go, you're going to come home at night going, this world sucks. It's just filled with jerks. It's just, we have no idea that we cause them to behave that way. And as we really work on this, what is harm? What do I do wrong? And we get friends and we go, if you see me do something that is harmful, would you get me afterwards and point it out? So you have a couple friends and you say to them, you have my permission to stick your nose in my business. And if you see me giving a waiter a hard time, if you see me getting into an argument that I don't need to be in, whatever you see, would you mind pointing it out? Now, if you do it this way, what's happening is you're getting rid of things that cause trouble in your life. It caused people to be upset. And your life starts, you keep running into better and better people. That's what happens. The more they help you see, you're not doing it deliberately. This is just how you were brought up. This is force of habit. Oh, I always do this. I like to tease the lady in the dry cleaning shop. That's not teasing. That's not even close to it. It's not? No, it crushes her. Really? Wow. So then we stop doing it. And we start using other, happier things, nicer things. And pretty soon they're smiling when we come in. They're smiling. Fred, hey. And then you go, hey, what the hell? And your little stops during the day are cheering you up. Everywhere you go, you're getting cheered up because of how nice people are. And you have no idea you're responsible for all of this. So what a powerful step. So to really examine what harm means is a wonderful thing. And so the expansion of that I felt was a really helpful thing. Then there, the discussions of 6 and 7 I could talk about for a long time. Suddenly these steps, instead of we've completed them, they're the ones that separate the men from the boys, the girls from the women. They're going to last a lifetime. Oh, I thought I was finished. Now it's a lifetime. Let's throw the 12 and 12 away. I like it. It's done. I'm on my way. I'm happy. I saw the light. I'm holding on to the spirit of the universe. I'm walking along. Now you're telling me things aren't that good. That's why I don't like the 12 and 12. It's a killjoy. It's shattering my illusion. So you can see why you would have these different reactions. But if we get beyond this, we'll see these go well together. They're perfect package. Some historians call it the Old Testament and the New Testament. I don't see the connection there, but I'm just passing it on. Then there's a discussion of prayer and meditation. What is meditation? In the big book, we go, well, we're going to go enter a period of meditation. What is it? And so we get a big discussion in the 11th step. And we get the wonderful prayer of St. Francis, which is just a terrific thing. The first time you read the prayer of St. Francis, you go, what good is this? What the hell are you talking about? It's because it's way beyond anything we're capable of. That's what bothers us about it. And we start getting a much deeper discussion of forgiveness in the 12 and 12. This is one of the spiritual principles that is the most underused in AA. There are people in this room that haven't forgiven stuff that happened in high school. And you don't intend to. You discussed it once and said, no, screw that guy. I'm not going to ever let him off the hook. I'm going to sentence myself to permanently feeling bad about this because I don't even understand forgiveness. So there's a great rewards in making forgiveness a bigger part of your life. And, of course, it's in the prayer of St. Francis twice. There's more discussions of spiritual awakening. There's three or four different discussions of that. And there's a major discussion of practicing the principles in all our affairs, which the working with others is how to sponsor and how to call on somebody, et cetera, but there's no chapter on working the principles. So you go to the 12th step and half of that's where all those questions are in the 12 and 12. Are you doing this? Hey, could we skip that? I felt I was doing a lot better until I started reading those questions. They've ruined it. Then there was the thing in step one. How about the beginning of the 12 and 12? You know, Bob was talking about 60 pages before we get to step three or 45 pages before we get to step two. That's how important step one is. And I think that when you go to the 12 and 12, Bill captured it all in one sentence. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Man. Is that brilliant? I just think that is complete defeat. Raise your hand for complete defeat. Any complete defeat here? We're going to get complete. That's unconditional surrender. We're on the battleship. General MacArthur is going to tell you the terms. That's what's involved. If you want a spiritual life, not a partial defeat, not a partial surrender, complete, utter surrender. And then there was that thing in step one also, where he was raising the bottom. You remember that discussion? So that we could include younger people. And I remember when that came out, the term sobriety is like an elevator came in, and you can get off at any level on the way down. Remember that? Well, that came out of raising the bottom to those that didn't go through the last 10 years or whatever it was. And it turns out, as we get educated by the younger people, that you can get there with alcohol and drugs a lot faster than you can with just alcohol. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, old timer. That's what we love, smart ass newcomers. Okay. There, I finished my hour and I'm just looking to see if I forgot anything. Oh, Jesus. This is this one a lot of people don't like. When we get to step six, we find that a saying that we love in the big book gets re-examined. How many people don't love "it's progress, not perfection"? Don't forget that. Don't forget that. It's progress, not perfection. Bill said, I took another look at that. And What we really have to do is raise our eyes towards perfection. We have to raise our eyes. We have to experience the failure of not reaching perfection while we're struggling to get there. That's what the spiritual journey looks like. There's a thing in the 24-hour day book, the prayer at the bottom. I pray that I may be never satisfied with my spiritual condition. What the hell kind of a prayer is that? I pray I'm frustrated all the time. No, it's what spirituality really is. Let's say you play golf. Have you ever played a perfect game? But you're trying to come close, aren't you? Maybe you're a writer. Have you written the perfect book? Well, it was close, but I know I can do better. There's a lot of places in life where we're shooting for something that we're not going to reach, but it's the reason that we keep growing, is that we put a target up here that's much higher than settling for what we got. And so when he raises the bar, so it's progress towards perfection, is what I think we get out of the 12 and 12. I have run out of material. We've been sitting here long enough, so let's wrap it up. And Dick, do you have anything you want to say? You're going to close the Lord's Prayer for us? Thank you all very much. All right. You want me to do it?